This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And in today's program, an exclusive interview with a legislative legend, Senator Mike Gravel, who opposed the Vietnam War, who published the Pentagon Papers, who opposed the Atomic Energy Commission and the nuclear power industry. We'll be speaking with him about many things, including democracy and a comparison of the clandestine wars in Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia, and those today in Afghanistan, Yemen, Somalia, Pakistan, and elsewhere. This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at station WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and today we have the very special privilege of presenting a legislative legend of the United States, an extended conversation in the person of Senator Mike Gravel, the former Alaska senator from 1969 to 1981, also formerly a candidate for the presidency of the United States of America. Among his many works, he is well known for his initiative in publishing the Pentagon Papers under the auspices of the United States Congress, his opposition to the Vietnam War, and also his opposition to the commercial expansion of nuclear power plants in the United States, where he sponsored a bill to impose a moratorium in 1971 on nuclear power plant construction, as well as to make utilities liable for any hazards or consequences of their operation. He is also very much involved in Democratic politics today, and that's Democratic with a small d. And we'll be speaking about that as well. So let us now welcome Senator Mike Gravel. How are you, sir?
Thank you, Robert, for having me on your show.
Well, let's just begin with what are you up to these days?
Well, the latest is the filing of a initiative issue in Massachusetts. What we've designed is an initiative that, when enacted by the voters of Massachusetts, would create a 9/11 commission, a citizens commission, I might say, that would have grand jury powers of Massachusetts to be able to subpoena people and put them under oath and pursue an fair and impartial investigation of what happened in the lead-up to 9/11, what happened on 9/11, and what happened in the aftermath of 9/11, which was, of course, the initiation of three wars and the expansion thereof today. And, of course, one of the wars being the War on Terror, which provides, which will go on to infinity, which will provide the underpinning for the military-industrial complex. Now, with this initiative in Massachusetts, we intend also to file one in Oregon and California and several other states. The only limitation we have in picking up maybe five or more states is the ability to raise the funds to be able to finance the campaign to collect the signatures to place the initiatives on the ballot, and then to wage a modest campaign, because I doubt that we'll need a great deal of money for the campaign, because I don't envision any real opposition of a public nature. So that's what's going on. If anybody is interested, they could go to 9-11CC, which stands for Commission Campaign, cc.org, and there'd be a place to really become informed, the text of the initiative itself, and to be able to contribute to funding this national operation.
It seems your post-congressional career has enabled even more activism on your part. In addition to this, I'm aware that you're involved in a national initiative for democracy, about which we'll speak later in the program. We are speaking with the Honorable Mike Gravel. And Senator, can you help bring those of us who are new students to clandestine wars up to date on what was the significance of your taking the initiative during the controversy of the secret memoranda of the so-called Pentagon Papers? during the Vietnam War and publishing them in the Congressional Record. We are here today in a world where media sometimes is distracting, where institutions are sometimes secret, and activities are unknown. Can you tell us how significant that was then and how that contrasts to the level of knowledge of the American people today?
Well, the significance of it then, and it's still applicable today, is that the Pentagon Papers was merely a history that was commissioned by Robert McNamara, the then Secretary of Defense. He was disenchanted with the war and was curious, intellectually curious, as to how we got into that mess. And so he commissioned this study. After he read it, he classified it and put it on the shelf. Well, if it was important for Robert McNamara to satisfy his interest, it's 1,000 times more important for the American people to know that 3 presidential administrations lied to the American people, which brought about our involvement, which brought about the death of more than 58,000 Americans and more than 3 million Southeast Asians. Now, something that horrendous, for it to take place, the people need to know this ahead of time. And of course, they don't. And that's the situation that we have today. We saw it in the aftermath of 9/11, when supposedly Osama bin Laden, the author of 9/11, supposedly, was in Afghanistan. And so what do? We send some troops into Afghanistan, depose the Taliban, and really can't get our hands on Osama bin Laden, because what we did is withdraw some of the forces and then went on the other side of the world and attacked Iraq. And we attacked it under false pretenses. That was that it was harboring weapons of mass destruction. And we had no concrete intelligence that that was the case. We stovepiped the intelligence until the White House got what they wanted. And that was some suspicions. And so we saw the government lie to us again. And a distinguished person like Colin Powell gets suckered into lying to the world before the United Nations. It's tragic. And, of course, what 9/11 brought about was aggressive torture by American officials, military, CIA, torturing human beings, thinking that they're going to extract worthwhile information. I have a background in intelligence, and I got to tell you, you don't get good intelligence through torture. You get what they tell you what you want to hear. What you get with good intelligence is a clever approach, intellectual approach, finding what's the self-interest of the people involved, and you can get some good intelligence that way. In any event, 30 days after you have the people, to continue interrogating or intelligence is really a dead letter. If you're going to get anything worthwhile, you're going to get it right at the beginning. And torture is not the best way to get it. So that's the whole message of the Pentagon Papers, was that our government lied then. It continues to lie now, overwhelmingly. And that's just the nature of the beast of representative government. In other words, people who hold power want to hang on to power, and yet they have to cover up their mistakes. And what politicians don't do, which is what the people would do in direct democracy, when the politicians make a mistake, they don't admit error, because it would then inure to their decrement. They'd have it used against them in the next political campaign. But if the people directly had committed an error, they feel the pain, and they would just change directions immediately. That's the difference between direct democracy and representative government. And of course, since the government is always protecting itself, and I say government, I'm talking about individuals in government. I'm talking about the presidents, the secretaries, the members of Congress. They're all tied in this together, whether it's the present wars that we're experiencing or wars in the past, except for the Second World War, and even that. Roosevelt had set up a situation that almost literally forced the Japanese to go to war or to retreat from China, which of course would have been the proper outcome. And so I'm not critical about what Roosevelt did in that regard, but it just goes to show that people who hold power can manipulate events and acts that the people have no idea what's happening to them in that regard.
In your publication of the papers in the Congressional Record, what kind of recriminations or trepidations did you encounter?
Well, from a certain group of people, I was considered a traitor. From others within the peace community, I could walk on water. and of course, neither one are applicable to me. It's just something I felt deeply about, that our country was waging a war without reason. Supposedly, the domino theory, and even the perpetrators at the level of a high level of government didn't buy into the domino theory. That's what they told the American people, that if South Vietnam falls, then the rest of Southeast Asia will go communist. That's just a lot of rot.
That was my other phone ringing. We're having a Sergio Leone moment. Apparently they're on to us.
You got the music right. I've got the my phone. It works on the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Well, thank God you're out of Washington.
Yes, well, that's right. But where was I? Here. Catch me up on where I was.
Well, the recriminations that you might have gotten, but let me extend the question in this way. How, since then, do you think, if at all, the collective national public intelligence has improved or deteriorated in the context of a sensationalistic network monopoly and in the ambitious hope of institutions like WikiLeaks?
Well, first off, you really, it's a broad question. Daniel Ellsberg and I discussed recently, in fact, when he published his book, Secrets, I wrote in the back of it for the flap that there's been no change. In fact, it's gotten worse. And that's really sad to say. And of course, mainstream media is more than part of the culprit in this regard, because in the old days, at least the New York Times and the Washington Post and the others had the guts to publish to a good degree. But when you saw the New York Times along with the Washington Post gin up a war with Iraq, you've got to really understand that we've come a long way downhill. And not only ginning up a war with Iraq, they've done the same thing with Iran. We've demonized through the media Iran to the point where it could explode. Of course, you certainly don't think it was an accident that four nuclear scientists in Iran were assassinated on the streets. You think that's the gang war?
I interviewed
nuclear scientists. Who's involved with that? Who's speaking out the most?
Well, one person who has some opinion about that is Viktor Ostrovsky, whom I interviewed some years ago when a similar event took place.
Yeah. These things, the government just goes willy-nilly. There's no accountability. And the only blessed thing that's happened has been WikiLeaks and Julian Assange with his guts to stand up and reveal things. And he's doing it intelligently. And then Bradley Manning. And if Bradley Manning is guilty of putting out these reports and putting out this other information of cables within the embassies, more power to them. The only thing that saves our democracy is that hopefully the government leaks like a sieve. But here you get the reaction Obama, who campaigned on transparency, has been five times more aggressive than any other presidential administration in chasing down whistleblowers and leakers. Does that give you an idea where we're at today? It's worse. And mainstream media is not nearly as responsive today as it was during the Vietnam War. But of course, during the Vietnam War, you got to keep in mind that mainstream media had a hand in ginning it up, but at least they turned tail on it and were very aggressive at the time of the release of the Pentagon Papers.
Having seen firsthand and close up and inside the Congress the conduct and escalation of the war in Vietnam, do you see any qualitative differences in the way that covert wars and military escalations thereof are being conducted today as opposed to then?
Well, first off, you must understand that we have a long history of covert wars and covert operations. And you could go back to, and I'm sure there's instances before that, you can go back to the Mexican War in 1848. You know, we created an incident so that we could go to war. You had the same thing with the Spanish-American War. World War, I could tell you some horror stories. There's a book out there by a gentleman by the name of Serpico about 11-11-11, how we had 10,000 American soldiers die between 5 o'clock in the morning when the armistice was signed and 11 o'clock when it went into effect. That means the generals and officers were still sending people over the top. We lionize our leaders. We think they walk on water. Well, I tell you, they're individuals who are desirous of power, and there's nothing wrong with that. We do need individuals that will understand that with power you can do some great things, but you can do some terrible things. And what we see is, by and large, terrible things. We don't need to be in Afghanistan now. We don't need to be in Iraq. We should have never gone into Iraq, and we should never have gone into Afghanistan in a destabilizing fashion. You know, the Taliban at the time were prepared to give us Osama bin Laden if we could provide evidence that he was the perpetrator of 9/11. That was the situation then. And when you look at Iran, Iran opened up all of its files of all of its terrorist group knowledge to the United States right after 9/11. They wanted a rapprochement. We're the ones that did chase them away.
Our guest is Senator Mike Gravel, the former senator from Alaska who served from 1969 to 1981, published the Pentagon Papers, opposed the Vietnam War, and the expansion of nuclear power plants in the United States. And Senator Gravel, I'm wondering if you, having seen the escalation in Vietnam, the trauma of the Tet Offensive, and shuffling of feet in terms of the inevitable withdrawal from Vietnam. Today in Afghanistan, we are seeing the same thing of strategic hamlets not being maintained under the control of the United States or NATO ISAF forces. We're seeing the resurgence of local opposition, however one may judge that opposition. And we're seeing a reluctance to withdraw. Do you see any dangerous parallels between the state of the war in Afghanistan today and the latter phases of the Vietnam War?
Yeah, there's no difference. There's no difference. It's the same. The same psychology in both instances, and it's a military psychology that, oh, we can win. Well, what is there to win? There was nothing to win in Vietnam. Today, Vietnam is still a communist country, and it enjoys most favored nation status with the United States in trade. Now, what did the Vietnam War mean? It meant that millions of people died in vain. That's what it meant, because circumstances haven't changed. They're still what they are. Here we're dealing with China. They're our biggest trading partner. They're our biggest banker, in point of fact. Here, we sanction Cuba today. For what? Because it's a communist or a socialist country, however you want to call it. That makes no sense. We should be trading with them. But here again, what wags the tail is the people in Miami, people who left Cuba when Fidel Castro first arrived, that they have acquired a lot of power, influence, and use it. And so they determine our foreign policy with respect to Cuba. Does it surprise you that Israel determines, or AIPAC, which is supported of Israel, determines our foreign policy in the Middle East? Mm-hmm. And oil checkmates part of that foreign policy with our treatment of Saudi Arabia and of course, now Iraq, that we've got control over. These are the shenanigans of government that don't make any sense. And if the people had a valid source of of information, then they could react to it. But they can't react to it now properly. All they can do is react to the manipulation that takes place, whether it's done by Fox TV and the whole Rupert Murdoch system that misinformed and really, really bring about great ignorance of the electorate. Now, the benefit to alter that, the benefit of direct democracy, is that people will have to take responsibility for their actions and will be obviously become better informed through the process. But when you have representative government, then it doesn't work that way. Let me give you an example about how the mind of a politician works with power. When you're about to make, whether it's a senator, president, a mayor, governor, city councilman, when you're about to make a public decision, the first thing that comes into your mind is, how does this affect me? Getting me reelected, getting me into another position. And this is nothing wrong with that. That's just human nature. We would all be concerned about putting our jobs in jeopardy. The second thing that comes to mind of this elected, of this public person, is how does this affect the people who put the money up to get me here and to keep me here? And at the third level, how does this affect my party? Because if my party's in power, I've got more power. Now, mind you, I'm at the third level, and I haven't even addressed the public interest. Mm. That is a generic flaw to representative government, and it's not correctable by representative government itself.
We're speaking with Senator Mike Gravel, formerly the senator from Alaska, and he is also involved in a national initiative for democracy, about which we'll speak after a short break. But just to culminate on this issue of the contemporary clandestine wars, whose form has remained pretty much unchanged from the times of the Vietnam War and others before that, there is what I think is one difference, one morphological difference, and that is the high degree of civilianizing, as it were, the clandestine wars, the war in Iraq, Afghanistan, where the number of so-called civilian military or military-associated contractors rivals and may sometimes even exceed the number of official U.S. troops on the ground. Does that add a new wrinkle in reversing the stubbornness of legislators and the chauvinistic pronouncements of eternal war?
Boy, you just hit the nail on the head, and I'll fess up that I'm partially responsible. When I received the Pentagon Papers from Daniel Ellsberg, I was in the process of filibustering the draft. We had concluded that Lyndon Johnson was able to raise the troops at one point in Vietnam to 500,000. And he could do this because of the draft and the young people. That's the reason why the young people that took to the streets because they had no political power to alter the situation. So I and Mark Hatfield decided that we would set up a filibuster and force the expiration of the draft so that the next president would be required to use reservists. And that has interesting political consequences. Well, we succeeded. The draft ended in 73. And what had happened now is as the government wants to expand its military establishment, it does it through contractors, whether it's Blackwater, and they've changed their name to operate in other parts of the world, still under American contract. We have more, and this is a reasonable guesstimate, we have more contractors in Iraq now than we have military forces. And, of course, we've got the presence of these military forces, of these contractors, in all of the things we're doing in Yemen and several other countries. So we have, and I want to equate this so that people can clearly understand, we not only have all of these contractors, but keep in mind, the president has the largest secret army in the world in human history, and that is the CIA, which is funded by black box that even the Congress members don't even know what the heck they're voting on. So when you talk about the difficulties we have today, yes, it's been contractors. Now, you know, we don't have people in the service peeling potatoes like we used to during the Second World War. Now what we have is we hire a contractor, Halliburton, to feed the troops, and then we hire people like Blackwater and Cheney's old outfit to do contract activities for the government, whether it's espionage, whether it's assassination, you name it. The private sector is very entrepreneurial, and they can service any nefarious activity the government wants to undertake.
Shades of Milo Minderbinder. Our guest live today on 5 O'Clock Shadow is Senator Mike Gravel. He is the former senator from Alaska who has opposed the escalation of undeclared clandestine wars and the expansion of the nuclear power industry, the draft, and many other progressive causes. He is also involved in the National Initiative for Democracy, about which we shall speak in just a few moments. Mike, and we're going to take a two-minute break on the subject of democracy and continue with your work.
And let's hit nuclear, too, please.
Oh, absolutely, sir. As soon as we come back and hear now, tribute to democracy. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and this is 5 O'Clock Shadow.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those nights in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the feel that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the wars against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA. It's coming from the sorrow in the street, the holy places where the races meet, from the homicidal bitchin' that goes down in every kitchen to determine who will serve and who will eat. It's coming to America first, the cradle of the best and of the worst. It's here they got the range and the machinery of change, and it's here they got the spiritual thirst. It's here the family's broken, and it's here the lonely say that the heart has got to open in a fundamental way. Democracy is coming to the USA. I'm sentimental, if you know what I mean. I love the country, but I can't stand the scene. And I'm neither left or right. I'm just staying home tonight, getting lost in that hopeless little screen. And I'm stubborn as those garbage bags that time cannot decay. I'm junk, but but I'm still holding up this little wild bouquet. Democracy is coming to the USA. Sail on. Sail on, O mighty ship of state. To the shores of need, past the reefs of greed, through the squalls of hate. Sail on. Sail on.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and our live guest today is the Honorable Mike Gravel, former senator from Alaska. And we are going to talk about your work in a new modality of democracy in the USA. We just heard Leonard Cohen speaking of such things. And Mike, you were speaking about the nuclear crisis. What are your thoughts about hazards in the U.S. and the unprecedented global disaster that is hitting the food and exports and the supplies inside Japan as well as around the world?
Well, it's a tragedy. And, of course, it all stems from 1953 when Dwight Eisenhower spoke at the United Nations about the peaceful atom. And so probably over the guilt of using it as a weapon to kill people, we felt that we could salve our conscience by creating a peaceful atom. Well, of course, you can't. And that's the tragedy of it. What we've seen happen is that we don't have a way to control the waste. We can't guarantee the safety. Anything that's involved with human beings will really succumb to the law of unintended consequences. If it can go wrong, it will go wrong. It's just that simple. But what's really angers me today, and of course I took Obama on in the debate over that, when he had agreed with AIPAC that everything was on the table with respect to Iran. Well, that's code for the fact that you're prepared to use nuclear weapons. Now, it is part of U.S. Policy that we reserve the right to use nuclear bombs when we see fit. And, of course, what we saw was when we see fit is what happened with this false invasion of Iraq. So now we have that policy, and what are the consequences of it? We have to ask ourselves, who would we nuke and under what circumstances? I can't think of anybody I would nuke. Even in retaliation for somebody blowing up a dirty bomb, which would not be a nation, because we could annihilate any nation for really even thinking of it. But so what would you do? We lose some people, and we would indiscriminately, like we did in Iraq, punish people just because we're angry. Now, President Obama signed this treaty with Russia, the New START treaty. What they did is they broke their arms, patting themselves on the back. But what they did is they reduced the amount of warheads in active service by 100. Now, we have 1,700, and we have, and the Russians have about the same amount, maybe a little more. We have 5,000 nuclear warheads that have been dismantled or are supposed to be dismantled. Now, in order to get the START treaty passed, they had to agree to expand the amount of money to rehabilitate and improve our nuclear capability. Now, these 1,700 weapons are targeted on Soviet Union, on Russia, on China, North Korea, probably on Iran. Well, stop and think of how ridiculous it is for us to be targeting our nuclear weapons on China. Let me give you a figure that I think is horrific, and that is that we spend more in defense than all the rest of the world put together, and there's no nation that is really a threat to us. Now, if you want to make a comparison, the French spend about 5% of what we do on defense, the British about 5%, Japanese about 5%, Russia about 5%, China 10%. And so who could possibly be a threat to us? And we're broke, and we're acting as the policeman, self-appointed, I might say, policeman of the world, and we can't afford to do it. And so we're on an imperial kick, and you can only conclude one thing, that all of this is to satisfy the need for profit and greed of those that participate in the military-industrial complex. You have to have wars to expend the munitions of war so that you can refurbish them and continue to manufacture them and continue to do all the crazy things that we do in this regard. I'm for a proper defense. I recognize the world is somewhat immature, but not to the degree that we have. There's an interesting comparison. The British, at the height of their, in the 19th century, at the height of their leadership or imperialism, let's put it that way, they had a policy of only spending two times more than their nearest enemy. And that, of course, was Germany at the time. Now, what we're spending is so far beyond reason in that regard that it begs the question of why aren't Americans taking to the streets? We've got, what, 25 million people unemployed? You know, we say it's 9%. It's closer to 16 to 20%. And the reaction of our leadership, the policies we see in Washington right now, talking about the debt reduction. Sure, we need to get our house in order debt-wise, but who threw it out of order? Obviously, the Republicans, primarily under Ronald Reagan and George Bush, because of what they did, cutting taxes on the wealthy who did not need the taxes cut at all, and literally bankrupting the nation. And now, with the policies pursued by Obama and the Republicans and the entire Congress is cut back. They're trying to really, they're making the problem worse. What we need now is to spend some money as an incentive, recognizing that we got to be able to trigger the growth to kick in. And once growth kicks in, then we'll be able to retire this debt. That was proven during the administration of Clinton, who was really lucky that he had the dot-com procedures or economy going, which permitted him to raise enough taxes to be able to to create a surplus. And, of course, the Republicans have just gone the opposite direction. In cutting taxes, and then cutting the ability of the government to function. The government is our tool to act collectively. When you destroy the government, you destroy our ability to sustain ourselves as a community. And that's what's going on.
Senator Mike Gravelle, we only have a couple of minutes left in this encounter, but I wanted to also bring into the record something that you're very much involved in, the National Initiative for Democracy, which is endorsed by people like Noam Chomsky, Ralph Nader, the economic hitman author John Perkins, Michael Lerner, and others. Until we pursue that subject further in a future interview, Senator Gravelle, what is that National Initiative for Democracy?
National Initiative is a process, is a law that would permit people to make laws in every government jurisdiction of the United States. It would be a constitutional amendment and an act that sets up the procedures of how the people would legislate. It is not rocket science. People want to be empowered. They could reach on a shelf and vote for the national initiative, and they would be empowered to make laws in partnership with their elected officials. That's what's possible right now. The problem is that mainstream media doesn't give any attention to this possibility. I would ask people to vote, and you can vote on it. The Congress will never pass it. We've devised a way to go around the government using Article 7 of the Constitution as precedent. And so you could go to a website called ni4d.us, and you could learn all about it. You could vote for it. Now, with respect to 9/11, you should go to this website, and that is 9-11 www.cc.org. These websites contain the information that can equip people to act as citizens, and create for the first time, the poem that was read is real simple. We have never had government by the people. We've never had real democracy. We've had representative government. To get real democracy, you have to have the people join in the process of their own governance. Cicero said for freedom to exist, people must participate in power, and that's what the people need to do, is not give their sovereignty away on Election Day, but to use it as a legislator.
It has been such a great privilege to speak with you today, sir. The Honorable Mike Gravel, former senator from Alaska. His current work can be followed at www.mikegravel.us or ilikemiketv.com. Once again, thank you, sir, for an enlightening day that was more historical than hysterical. I wish we had more like you even today in the U.S. Congress.
Thank you very much, Robert.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. I'd like to give thanks for not only the presence of Mike Gravel, but Michael G. Haskins for engineering. And we conclude today's program inviting your comments at the Shadow, theshadow, at wbai.org. And we conclude with yet another look at democracy by way of Paul Robeson.
The flag I see, a certain word, and democracy. What is America to me? The house I live in, the friends that I have found, the folks beyond the railroad, and the people all around. The worker and the farmer, the sailor on the sea, the men who built this country, that's America to me. The words of old Abe Lincoln, of Jefferson and Payne, of Washington and Jackson, and the tasks that still remain. The little bridge at Concord, where freedom's fight began, our Gettysburg and Midway, and the story of the tan. The house I live in, my neighbors white and black, the people who just came here, or from generations back. The town hall and the soapbox, the torch of liberty, a home for all God's children, that's America to me. The house I live in, the goodness everywhere, a land of wealth and beauty, with enough for all to share. A house that we call freedom, the home of liberty, but especially the people, that's America to me. But especially the people,
and that was a live presentation of 5 O'Clock Shadow with Robert Knight, thanks to Senator Mike Gravel. You are tuned to listener-supported commercial-free community radio WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. And I must say, we must have more programs like this. We must have more interviews like this. Let's give that information out again. NI4D.us and 9-11CC.org. We'll be repeating that in the days to come.